new single, This Is America by Childish Gambino. So, for those of you who don't count among the more than 20 million views on YouTube, it's a song that's got a lot of people talking when it came out a little over 2 weeks ago. But it's not so much the song that has people talking, it's the video. Let's just say it's a far cry from Michael Jackson's Beat It video coming out in the day. I'm Michelle Tyreen Johnson, in for Gina Kaufman, and on today's Central Standard, we'll talk about This Is America. With me today is Glenn North. He's a poet based here in Kansas City. Hey, Glenn.
How are you, Michelle?
Great, good, great. And David Mohammed, a rapper and teacher from Shawnee Mission East. He is joining us via Skype from his classroom because it's that time of the year when teachers have to be in the classroom grading. You there, David?
Yes, ma'am. Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, Glenn, I'm gonna throw this to you.
Okay.
For someone who hasn't seen the video, what's happening? I mean, what's in the video?
Well, to me, it's an interesting juxtaposition of, you know, Afrobeat and hip hop, but you've got Donald Glover or Childish Gambino, who is like the focus, and he's doing several dance routines like you would see in a video. But juxtaposed against that is two specific scenes. There is so much going on and it's so multi-layered, but there's an initial scene of him kind of in a Jim Crow caricature pose, shooting a solo guitarist who's hooded in the head. And then there's a scene later in the video where Donald Glover, or Childish Gambino, I should say, there's a choir singing this happy, jubilant song, and he's thrown an automatic rifle, and he kills the choir. But that juxtaposition of kind of this happy music that is both, you know, African-based, and then there's a new term for what's going on in hip hop today, trap music. So you got those two styles of music, but it's like a video where you would see these several dance routines being played out, but it's juxtaposed against this horrific violence and rioting in the background. And the way that it's filmed, you know, the dancing and the rapping and all of that is like front and center, but in the background you see all this mayhem and chaos. And as you said before we started the show, it's very disturbing.
Yeah, that first time I saw it, it was really like, I was not ready.
Yeah. So it is far from a typical video, and I think that you know, Donald Glover's genius and the director of the video, whose name I can't pronounce, worked together to put together a piece of art that really is creating this national conversation.
You know, you mentioned that Childish Gambino is Donald Glover. So for those who aren't familiar, Donald Glover, the actor who's was on the show Community, he has a show Atlanta, and Childish Gambino is his alter ego. I was reaching this morning to remember that Garth Brooks had the alter ego of Chris Gaines, which was always kind of an interesting thing for an artist to have sort of two personas. David, what is it about this video that you think is different?
I think it's the same thing that Glenn North said. It's the juxtaposition of what's happening. We have an era of hip hop right now, which is very much just based upon doing what feels good in the moment. And it really celebrates drug culture and over-sexualization of society. And I think that with this video, what he does so well is you have, like Glenn mentioned, the trap sound, even the diction in which he's rapping is very much following what a lot of these mainstream rappers are doing now. But the content is so heavy that it kind of sucks you in that way. And so if a kid was to just listen to it on the radio, they might just get caught in the beat and not even listen to the words. But what the video does is it sucks you in through the beat, but then you have this very alter scening going on the entire time. And I think that alone really sticks with you. it really hits you because there's a part of you that wants to dance like the kids are doing in the video.
Right.
You want to nod your head, but then there's also a part of you that wants to like gasp or just like sit still for a moment or turn away maybe.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I thought it was interesting because I was watching Saturday Night Live the night that Donald Glover was guest hosting, and he was also the musical guest as Childish Gambino. And then while all that was happening, the video was dropping for people. And I was like, man, that guy knows how to like get people's attention.
He certainly does.
All at once. And I have to admit, when I saw the video, that first part of the video where, you know, he's just dancing, happy dancing, like every million videos you've seen. And then he takes out a gun and he shoots somebody sitting there in the head as he keeps dancing and keeps singing. Glenn, what do you think that is supposed to represent?
I think it represents our desensitization. The fact that gun violence is so prevalent that we just kind of take it as par for the course. It's what happens in America. Since he's released that video, we've had, again, another school shooting. And one of the things, although this isn't what you asked, because you do talk about initially when the video opens up, I was also taken by his ability to use his body in a way to communicate these historical references. Because there's a facial expression he makes when he first turns around, this reminiscent of the logo for Coon's Chicken or you know, the Pickaninny image that we see historically in stereotypical representations of Black people, the way he contorts his face, the way he contorts his body when he actually does shoot the gentleman that's playing the guitar. The fact that he chose not to wear a shirt, which many say is a nod to the album cover of Richard Pryor, that Negro, but you know, the other word.
Thanks for cleaning it up. Thank you.
That Negro's Crazy album. Right. So the way that he uses his
body. I didn't even think of that. Wow.
In the video, I think is really interesting. So I was struck by that. I'm also struck by the fact that he is the one that's perpetrating the violence. But in the background, you do see police in riot gear. You do see a police car. So I think had he had a white person perpetuating the violence, we'd be having a different conversation. So I think he's able to address the police brutality issue that we have that's so prevalent, but also the black on black violence that, and I don't even like that term,
you know what I mean?
Like that gets misused, but you know, the way that we harm each other. So it broadens the conversation in that he's the one that actually commits the act of violence so that you can't say, well, he's not dealing with that. He's, you know what I mean? I think he was very wise in that decision to, and it's very startling.
I thought that too. And David, I mean, you apparently are a music historian, so you know a lot more about this than I do. I had to, you know, kind of get up to date by reading blogs to go, oh my goodness, that was deeper than I thought. And one of the things that I read, and then I went back and looked at the video again and noticed, is that whole thing of when he shot the people, like the guy at the beginning, and then the choir of children in the middle of the video as they're singing a song, the gun is placed gently in a red cloth while the bodies of the dead are just sort of disrespectfully snatched away. David, what do you think about that?
Well, I think, as Glenn mentioned, it really just shows that we are very much desensitized to death. I've even seen some symbolization of there's the white horse of death lurks in the background of the video as well. And if you listen to the words, you know, a key lyric to me that he says is "Get your money, black man." Right. So it's like, no matter what, like whatever's going on, whatever you got to do, get your money, black man, and just keep moving forward. And I think that lyric can be taken so many different ways. It's like, this is going to happen. This is what it is. Get your money. Or, you know, maybe it's you might have to sell out. You might have to do, like you said, the pickaninny. You might have to blackface. And I think it points to movies like Bamboozled. I think it points to the Chappelle Show, where you had this kind of it was sarcastic. It was what's the word I'm looking for?
Sort of satirical.
It was satire.
Yeah, satirical.
Yeah. It was very much satire to show, like, we laughing and we smiling, but things are not all good, you know. And I'm just trying to get this money and move on because I can't fix this situation, right? Like, me alone can't fix this situation. And I think even when you watch, like, interviews of Childish Gambino, like, now they ask him to explain the video, he refuses to do it.
Yeah, that's like, interesting, isn't it? Yeah,
like, he will not go there. He's not trying to please anybody else. I think he made the video for himself, like, if anything else,
right?
You know, so.
And that was one of the things that struck me more so than the average video. I mean, I'm telling on my age when I say I'm old enough to remember when MTV was the new thing.
I remember it too.
Okay, you young pups. Okay, all right. I wasn't trying to, you know, but when it was a big deal when a video came out. Yes. And people like ran to the set to watch it, but there was more correspondence between the lyrics of a song and the video itself. Whereas if somebody was listening to this song, I mean, you would just probably think the song was about capitalism, black men get that money.
Mm-hmm.
Then you watch the video and it's like, whoa, there is so much going on here. Do you think, and either one of you or both of you can jump in on this, do you think that this is going to spark maybe a turn towards videos being as much about messaging and telling a story and activism of sorts as it is just, you know, something to accompany a song?
I'll speak. I feel like, one, you already have artists who have been doing that. I think what makes this different is that it's Donald Glover, because he does not have a history necessarily of going into race relations through his music. This is kind of a different jump for him. I've even seen interviews where he didn't want to talk about, you know, being black and things of that nature. So I think that he has a platform that's making it bigger. But I also think that not everybody can do it, because it'll come across as scripted or, hey, I want to make the next Childish Gambino, This Is America song or video. So it takes somebody who is in touch and intelligent enough to do it in a way that's artistic. It didn't feel forced. You know, as Glenn mentioned, you know, him being the one who committed the acts of violence, had it been a white person, it would have been too easy. It would have been like, oh, okay, that's expected. You know, and so I think that hopefully there's a more conscious tip, and hopefully this sheds light on the already conscious art that's been being done, and artists who are already of that nature.
And, you know, I just wanted to jump in really quickly, Michelle. Mr. Moo, also known as Brother News, mm-hmm. Mr. Muhammad that we're speaking mm-hmm. to, is very much a conscious a rapper. And
I appreciate that, bro.
And I would the better term is hip hop artist, and I appreciate what you're doing. One would hope that this would help to shape hip hop culture in a way that does lead toward activism. But one of the things that, you know, I hope does not happen is that people just start doing it because, oh, Donald Glover has this successful right. video, and then it becomes right. trendy. And then we do the very thing that he's critiquing, in that allowing ourselves to be amused and entertained and not really dealing with, you know, getting out there on the streets and doing some of the things that David is doing that actually do affect change in our community.
Right. I know what you mean. This morning when I was getting ready at home and trying to get hyped for the show today, and I had my music pumping and I was playing some Biggie, and I started going, whoa. Because
yeah.
I started listening to the lyrics, I
right,
was like,
right.
This is exactly what yeah. Childish Gambino was talking about.
Yeah. But you know what? I think that at the same time, not to cut you off, that's okay, right? Like I think if anything, we as black culture have to be okay with being multifaceted, just like
certainly.
Everybody else.
Certainly.
So every now and then, like, you know, you might just want to listen to some like ignorant stuff. Right. And I think that that's what he's looked like. If you look at the video, it touches upon all that. It's like,
right.
Like this crap is going on, but the kids are still dancing. Like, yeah. And you can look at it from two different angles. Like maybe those kids dancing is their survival.
Right.
Like that's how they cope because they can't afford therapy. They can't afford or have access to mental health, you know, counselors and things of that nature. And this is their reality. This is America for them. Their America is not like everybody else. So sometimes we need some Biggie. Sometimes we need some Cardi B just to feel good.
Right.
Because we know that our real life is so dark at times as Black people in America that if we always talk about the struggle and revolution, oh my goodness.
Like, right. You know,
it can be overwhelming.
It's like one of my favorite memes. I may be bougie, but I'm ratchet. Right, exactly. What we're talking about also reminds me of this one part of the song that I wanted to play. They're gonna find you like Paco Blau. Ooh, America. I just checked my following. Listen, you motherfuckers owe me. Come on, get your money, black man. 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 Glenn is over here jamming.
I was too.
right. And so I think that's the clip where he talks about contraband.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to look that up to go, okay, what is he talking about? And then it was like, oh, how Black people at one point in time were contraband. I mean that we mm-hmm. were the contraband, mm-hmm. and I'm like, man, he snuck in some stuff while throwing in a great beat.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the lyrics are seemingly, you know, simple, but there's a lot like and just as David was pointing out, there's so many different layers, you know, and even I can't remember the hip hop artist name that did the speaking in that particular part, but he was talking about getting his likes up. And I think that's another reference to, you know, in terms of like what's going on with social media, because mm-hmm. you've got the scene shortly after the choir gets slaughtered. They show up on the balcony, a bunch of people who in the midst of all this violence are still on their cell phone.
I saw that. Yeah. I noted that right away.
And, you know, either Facebooking or tweeting or whatever mm-hmm. you want to call it. And the artist that was doing the talking in that particular segment is one of the things that helped him become successful is, you know, his social media presence. And I don't know. If you listen to the lyrics, you know, several times, as I said, they're deceptively simple. There's a lot of symbolism in what he's saying in the actual lyrics of the song.
Yeah. And what you were talking about the social media. I mean, it's funny because that is going to end up being a good segue to the next segment, but it is about, we live in a society where we're almost living two lives at once. The lives we're actually living and the lives that are going to show up on social media. And, you know, when I saw the kids in that video looking down at their phones, they weren't looking at each other. They weren't even really looking at what was going on. And I was like, well, that's a good representation of what's happening inside. What do you think? Is there any way to get, and David, I'm going to ask this of you, although this applies to Glenn too in a different way. How do we get kids to see the deeper message?
I think we have to give kids the benefit of the doubt. Kids are smart, you know, and I think that, I mean, I've had conversations with students at school about this video, and they point out things that I don't even see, you know. I think we just have to provide kids with the platform to speak because they are so tapped in to social media and other things that they get distracted or they're burdened by school and other things like that. So providing them with the platform, it'd be interesting to have a conversation with kids about this very video on KCUR. Because they have a voice and they're showing that with, you know, the revolutionary movements that they've been conducting this whole time. They just need the platform. They just need the space and the energy to do it. And I think they'll shine. And I think that's what's so great about this video. You wouldn't get 20 million likes if it was just adults watching it.
Right. Like
the kids is watching it in class when they're supposed to be doing my class. But they're watching it, you know, yeah. And they are tapped in and they are thinking. It's just that as soon as they get off, they're tapped right back into Instagram and they're scrolling. So their mind goes somewhere else right away. And if they had 5 minutes afterwards to be able to speak about it, then you might get it out of them.
And also think, David and Michelle, that while social media does deserve we have to critique it. We have to examine it because it's changing our culture in such a significant way. But many recent movements, Black Lives Matter, Arab Spring, Occupy Wall Street, social media was the very tool that
right.
helped fuel the fire,
exactly
you know,
right.
of those movements. And so when you get young people excited about, and I don't know, yeah, excited is part of it, but when they are with people like David and the work that he does with the young people that he comes into contact with and the work that I try to do with the young people that I'm fortunate enough to engage with is if we can get them to have these conversations, then they can use social media and other tools of technology to really affect change. And if you look at any change that has ever taken place historically in America, it's always been young people at the forefront. And I don't think that this current moment in history is any different.
It is not any different, except that some people, some children, some kids are easier to relate to than others.
That's right.
For some people.
Yeah.
So, David Muhammad, rapper and social studies teacher, thank you for joining us today.
Appreciate it.
Mr. Poet Glenn North, thank you. But could you please stick around for the next segment?
I will. I just want to shout out David again, man. Nice hearing your voice, bro.
Yeah, hey, and you know you've been propping me up, but I gotta prop him up as well. He's doing excellent work as well, and we actually know each other, and he's helped my wife out with her writing. So appreciate you, brother.
Yes, sir.
All right, lots of love. So after this short break, we'll talk about the recently publicized cases of white people calling the police on people of color for just being, well, people of color, I guess. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm in for Gina Kaufman today. So for people of color, and which includes all people, Black, Native American, Latino, Asian, pretty much anybody who's not Caucasian, being wrongfully reported to the police can be a real concern, even though it's not a new concern. But in recent weeks, we've heard of the incident at Starbucks where the police were called on Black men waiting for a business associate, two Native American young men on a college tour, a Black graduate student who had the police called on her for sleeping in a common area, a group of professional Black women golfing too slowly, and even a man barbecuing in a public park for using charcoal. We want to hear from you. Share your thoughts about these cases and what you've experienced by calling 816-235-2888. We're with us about to speak on what some have called racial profiling, or profiling by proxy when someone calls the police to do it, is Glenn North, who's still with us. He's a poet here in Kansas City. Hello again, Glenn.
Hello.
Thank you for bearing with me for a second segment.
Sure.
And Lisa Thoreau, are you there?
I am.
Great. I did push the right button. Okay, all right. Lisa is the executive director of Strategies for Youth, a nonprofit training and policy organization looking to improve police and youth interactions. They also address issues of disproportionate minority contact. So, Lisa, I'm going to start with you on this since you work in this realm. Why do you think there seems to be this dramatic public attention to these incidents now?
Well, I think one of the greatest tools of the civil rights movement of these last couple of years has been the cell phone and the absolute refusal of young people, especially people of color, to be treated this way, thank God. And I think some of the politics right now has said because the Department of Justice is not committed to racial equality and is allowing the rollback of police oversight, it's easy to do what you want and to use the police to further your agenda. And this is nothing new. It's just getting caught. And we're very excited to see it getting caught.
Right. So what do you think is the lasting impact on the children that you talk to about this?
Well, we call this racial profiling by proxy, and it's a word coined by a former police chief, Bob Stewart, who was active in Florida and Washington, D.C., because it's profiling, which occurs because someone does not like the color of the person or their religious belief or their sexual proclivities, and they use the police to threaten, harass, and frighten youth. And youth come out of these situations, or adults even, profoundly frightened and distrusting of police, and they are not sure of the police legitimacy. Some police I've encountered say, we know exactly how this works. We know exactly what we're being used to do, and it puts us in a terrible position, and we don't like it.
And as you know, Glenn, and I know, Glenn, as two, you know, grown black folk,
right,
that it's not just kids who this happens to. It's not just teens who this happens to. In fact, pretty much most of these incidents lately, with the exception of the Native American young men on college tour, have been adults.
Right.
What do you think that's about?
Well, I think it is, as Lisa said, it's nothing new. We just have different ways of capturing how it happens. And she mentioned the cell phone. And one of the things, I'm a poet, but I'm also the director of education and public programs at the Black Archives of Mid-America. And I'm really excited we have this exhibit that will be coming in June through the National Endowment for the Humanities. And it's called For All the World to See, Visual Culture and the Struggle for Civil Rights. And one of the pivotal images is the photograph that was taken of Emmett Till with his open casket funeral, and how that ignited the civil rights movement. So I think the way that we are portrayed, the way that black people or people of color are portrayed in the media, the climate that we live in under the current administration, I think has, you know, like Lisa said, this has always existed. But I think that there are people who view people of color a certain way who feel a lot more comfortable acting on their opinions and their thoughts. And so the fact that we even have to shape language to, you know, 20 years ago, you probably wouldn't have heard the term profile by proxy.
Right.
But the fact that we're codifying it now, I think is at least, if we're willing to confront what's happening, we can then start to fix it. So I appreciate the work that Lisa's doing. But yeah, I've been in situations like when I'm driving, you know, we talk about driving while black, like there's a different level of awareness when I'm driving in Mission Hills than it is when I'm driving down Paseo, you know?
Right.
And so it's something that, as people of color, we're always aware of, always sensitive to, and are always dealing with, you know, in terms of our daily, you know, comings and goings and interactions with other people. But it just is to me not anything new, but perhaps with technology and new insight, we can confront it in a way that really will affect change.
We have to make systemic changes. Dispatchers need to be trained. We have to have consequences for people who make that kind of call. We need to have data on those calls. And a lot of law enforcement agencies are not equipped to do any of that, but I believe they must. And a lot of them will claim, well, we have to answer every call. But when you talk to people in the communities where they're policing, you often hear calls don't get answered immediately for many other things that are much more urgent. So this really needs to be addressed systemically, not just through training, but through internal oversight mechanisms and external accountability mechanisms.
And we do have a dispatcher who works out of Florida who's going to be joining us shortly, because that's one of the things I want to have that as part of the conversation, mm-hmm. because on Facebook, whenever these issues come up, I mean, that's the thing that comes up over and over again. Like, why are the police even sent out on these situations?
And you know, Trevor Noah, to Lisa's point, did a clip a bit about how, you know, there should be a penalty associated with the person who makes the call if it turns out to be a non-event, or you know, like you mentioned, the woman who was calling the police about the black people that were using charcoal to barbecue in the park. And I do think that some kind of consequence is a very good step in that direction. And, you know, speaking as a black person, when we have incidents in our community, we're hesitant to call the police, not necessarily always because we don't trust the police, but we know that there is a consequence when the police show up. And if they're given information that has them in a heightened sense of danger, you know, as they're approaching the perceived or alleged altercation, that can have very dire consequences. So people of color don't play like that. I mean, we don't just call the police for no reason, you know?
Glenn, I have to disagree with you there. I think a lot of white people know what dire consequences could happen, too.
Uh-huh.
And, they're just willing to risk that because that's how they think, some of them anyway.
Yeah.
But I don't think we can ever forget our history, which is that police were used during Jim Crow and before that to enforce racial segregation and racial oppression. And so it's in our collective memory, I guess, and I salute those officers who say, no, don't use me for that, I won't go. But the key change here is systemic reform, starting at the leadership saying, no, we're not answering that kind of call. And frankly, many departments use a triage system about which calls they do answer. So the fact that some departments refuse those ways of saving precious resources and sending officers out on what I would call frivolous calls disturbs me, because there is a clear-cut alternative available.
So we have a caller. I'm going to put, okay, Robert, you there?
Yeah.
Hey,
yeah,
so here. I see you called in. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, besides, I stay abreast of a lot of these incidents just because of my interest in the issue. But one of the things that I thought tied into your previous discussion that with this is the fact that with apps like Nextdoor and social media like Facebook, There's kind of a deep-seated underbelly of this profiling by proxy that occurs on neighborhood watch groups.
Oh, and yeah, I've heard and seen a lot of those.
Yeah, and I'm a resident of an older area of Kansas City that I moved into a couple years ago, and just flabbergasted by how much bigotry and just racial bias and profiling. Children who are just behaving like children playing in a park, you know, are suspicious, and, you know, people taking, walking their dog or taking the trash out. Even once my wife and I were walking and our phones were blowing up with social media posts on the neighborhood watch group, because supposedly we matched some profile of a couple that had been suspected of breaking into places. Mm. And cops are being called on just people randomly, and it's occurring on a massive basis, and I'm here in Kansas City, but I bet you just across the nation.
A friend of mine who is thank you, Robert, for that because we all can sort of relate to that. A friend of mine who's white, who lives in Johnson County, who knew I was going to have this segment coming up, was telling me about a thing called Ring, which is, I guess, a version of Neighborhood Watch, where people can look through their doors and report if they see someone suspicious. And she said that she had there were so many suspicious notifications she got just literally because a black person was in the area. They weren't doing anything. They were literally just in the area, and that she got so many notifications, she had to turn her notifications off. And she noticed that when people would steal packages from porches, nobody would report that, because when you looked at the camera later, it was a white person taking the packages. And so I thought that was interesting when she told me that. Thank you so much, Robert. I'd like to get the perspective of a dispatcher. Constance is a dispatcher and trainer who works out of Florida. She's asked us not to use her last name because of the sensitivity of the cases that she's dealt with. So she joins us now via Skype. You there, Constance?
Yes. Hi, I'm here. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate this.
Of course.
Because I just think that this is such an unheard perspective in all of these conversations. So you're a police dispatcher. So that means you're the front line of when people call. And what could you just briefly tell us a little bit about what that means, what you do? What is the first thing you do when you pick up after someone is called 911?
Well, we pick up the phone, and obviously the first question is the most important, is where. You know, if the line disconnects, if I know where, I can at least send someone there if I don't know anything else. So we, you know, it's who, what, when, where, why, and how. It's not, in some ways, it's, I feel, not too different from a journalist trying to figure out what's going on. So that really is what I have to do, is determine all of those things, and also to try and filter out the fluff, you know, just the facts sort of thing, try to condense it down.
I would imagine a dispatcher would have to be a very calm, even-tempered person who keeps emotions out of it. Is that, would you think that's the case for most people who are dispatchers for public safety places?
Absolutely. We have to be the calm voice on the other end of the line, because when we speak to people, they're never in a good mood. You know, they're hurt, they're in pain, they're angry, they're scared. So we have to be the anchor for them to focus on so that we can get the information. That isn't to say that we don't all have our meltdowns and our moments, but we try to keep that until we're off the console.
Okay. You know, I think we're going to take a break. Lisa Thoreau, Director of Strategies for Youth, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate that. Constance and Glenn, could you hang with me through this break?
Yes.
In a minute, we'll take your calls on this issue at 816-235-2888. We're also on Twitter at KCURCST. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson, in for Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson, in for Gina Kaufman. I'm here with poet Glenn North, who's right here with me in the studio, and Constance, a phone dispatcher from Florida, who's asked us not to use her last name. Thank you guys for sticking with me on this. I know this can be an awkward topic, even though it's one people talk about a lot. Constance, in this rash of news about people of color having the police called on them, one of the questions that people ask over and over again is, why are the police even called out to respond to something when people are doing something that is obviously and perfectly legal? I mean, do you have any sort of insight into that?
Well, as to why, I mean, people are operating off of their own biases. It was actually interesting that you had Lisa Thoreau on, because I read, I believe, her article from Vera Institute of Justice when she was talking about the people's, how their biases and the biases of responding officers can influence the outcome of a call. And a lot of people, you know, they have their own preconceived notions of what people should and shouldn't be doing and who should and shouldn't be doing things. And so they call us. And for us, sometimes it's very difficult to decipher what is actually going on. You know, I only have the phone. I don't have any sort of visual cues or anything. I only have the words that they're telling me. So if a person calls in and they say something that sounds like it could be a crime, I'm obligated to put a call in.
Right. And let me ask you this. Is there some sort of magic language that removed your discretion, or do you have discretion in deciding whether to send police out?
It varies by agency. Different agencies have their own policies governing what they can and can't do. I know for ours that when we receive a phone call, if it's something that we're determining there's no crime being committed, there's no issue there, that we can and we have told people, I'm sorry, but that's not a police matter and we're not sending someone out. But again, that has to be something that I can determine. If someone uses, you know, certain language or says certain things, I may think that they are, you know, lying, but I can't take the chance that they're not.
Okay, so I got to ask the obvious million-dollar question that I would kick myself for months for if I did not ask this specific question. So how often is race the only indication of suspicious activity that people provide?
Oh, let's see. Well, that's actually more of a complicated question than you think.
Okay.
Again, because a lot of things factor into it, where you live, for instance. I don't know about where you live, but I live in South Florida. I live, you know, 20 minutes up from Miami. So I have cultures from all over the world mm-hmm. living here. And so sometimes it's difficult for me to really determine if race is an issue because we all are around each other so much that I don't know that race is necessarily such a problem. But then again, everybody has biases against other people. I know that call volume wise, I definitely have more calls where race doesn't appear to me. And I mean, I'm a white female, so what do I know? But it doesn't appear to me that that's the reason they're calling. It does sound like the person's race is just happens to be a part of the call. It's not the reason for the call. We may get calls about a suspicious person walking around the neighborhood at 3 o'clock in the morning. Anybody walking around a neighborhood at 3 o'clock in the morning is weird because people are sleeping.
Right.
So when we go out there and it turns out, oh, it's a black male or, oh, it's a Latin male. Okay. They just happen to be that.
But what about when somebody calls in and it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon and they're walking around? Does that tend to tilt it toward another sort of interpretation of why they're calling?
It really does.
Yeah.
It really does. A good example of that. I had a woman call and it was about 6 o'clock in the morning and she called saying, oh, you know, there's a young black male and he has a backpack and a hoodie and he's walking around the neighborhood. It's very suspicious and I don't recognize them and you should send someone out. And I said, and I'm looking at the clock and I said, so he's walking with a backpack. Yeah. Is he walking towards a bus stop for school? And there was just the longest pause and it was just like, well, never mind. And then she hangs up. And it's just people are so quick to assume the worst. And it's just like this critical thinking aspect of it just goes right out the window.
Right. Which actually, I want to take a pause and take this call from Kay. Kay, hi. Thanks for calling in. You had a comment to make about the topic?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. When I grew up, and I'm 75 years old, I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in a very poor neighborhood. But I never had any fears. I knew my neighbors, and I knew that people could be trusted. I walked to school. I took the streetcar. My family taught me that people are righteous and good. But when I watch the news today, all I know is I should be very afraid, very, very, very afraid. There are rapists out there and terrorists and bad people with hoodies. And our national leaders are telling us we should be suspicious and fearful and just not trust anybody because nobody should be trusted. And that bothers me a great deal. So I've turned off the TV and I've stopped listening to the news because I don't like that message. It's not true.
Thank you for that, Kay. We appreciate your comments. Constance, when you have people call you in, do you feel like how people are dressing is part of what they are calling about in addition to their race?
Not really. I don't really think so. I think if they do, it's not something that's really stood out. I mean, I do, again, live in South Florida where it's like 98 million degrees, so everyone's kind of dressing the same.
Mm-hmm.
But there is you know, you will obviously, I think, get more calls on a person walking around in, you know, what someone would consider, you know, inappropriate clothing, you know, hoodies or, you know, slouching pants or anything like that, as opposed to someone walking around in a suit. You know, that's just another bias that we have.
What is interesting, that reason I asked is previous caller mentioned hoodies, and I mean, hoodies in of themselves are not indication of criminal behavior or criminal proclivities. Thank God, because I got a lot of hoodies. but it, you know, it is one of those things where I do think it's factors that people are sort of trained to believe the worst about certain people. And I think what has been upsetting about recent news events is about people doing very legitimate things that people do all the time, like the Starbucks thing comes to mind. I mean, I am a big Starbucks person. I mean, the amount of time I've been in a Starbucks waiting for somebody, writing, and everybody else is doing that. And I can't imagine somebody coming up and having the police come up to me because my drink is empty and I'm no longer technically a customer. And you know, Glenn, I need you to help me out on this. Don't you think that as a person of color, because it's sort of the opposite of what our previous caller says, she's talking about the fear that people have, who are citizens who are worried about being victims of crime. But as a person of color, don't you sometimes feel the fear of being out minding your business? I don't know about you. I mean, I'm hyper conscious of how I do things sometimes.
It's the sixth sense that you develop. You know, it's certain spaces that you walk into and you immediately feel that you're not welcome. And I think that it's also the idea of power by proxy, in that a white person who calls the police for these innocuous occurrences, you know, Starbucks or, you know, the young lady that you mentioned who was asleep in the common area on the university campus. I do think that, you know, I've not done the empirical research, but that a white person knows if I call the police on a person of color, I'm seated in a position of power to determine whatever actions are going to take place on that person of color. And I don't think that if the situations are reversed, we feel the same way. I mean, I call the police on a white person, I'm worried about how the police are going to treat me when they show up, you know?
Exactly. We have a call from Reggie. Reggie, are you there?
Yes.
So what are your thoughts listening to this conversation?
Well, I was kind of thinking about how we realize that in this country, racial tensions in the past were terrible. And to get a lot of these things fixed, we had to, you know, as black people, we had to rely on white people to do this. One of the things I was wanting to comment on is white people who find this appalling, why not get a movement going against this sort of thing? Get more involved. And you see this happening, why not say, look, that's not right. You're guilty by allowing this thing to happen when you see it and you don't do anything about it.
You know, that's a great point, Reggie. One of the things that I thought was really interesting was the white woman who saw the other white woman ask, you know, basically giving the black man a hard time and calling the police on him because he was using charcoal while grilling.
Yeah.
Which
barbecue Becky.
Right. I know, right. I mean, we could there could be a whole show on on by this woman that she has created. And I thought, I even put this up on Facebook. Okay, this is an example of how white allies can help. They can be part of the conversation.
It's funny how they can be so advocates for animals. Why not be advocates for humans that are being treated badly?
All right. Okay. So, Glenn North, a poet in Kansas City, thank you for joining us. And Constance, thank you for your experiences and sharing them with us. You know, our time is up for today's show, and you can listen back to any of our episodes at kcur.org Central Standard. I'm sorry, at kcur.org/Central Standard. This one will be there by the end of the day, kcur.org/Central Standard. If you missed yesterday's discussion about the new and noteworthy podcast of 2018, be sure and check it out online. Tomorrow, we bring you a special broadcast of the education podcast, No Wrong Answers, taking a look at the issue of school choice in Kansas City. Today's Central Standard was produced by Coy Duggar. Our team includes Sylvia Maria Gross and Coy. I'm Michelle Tyrene Johnson. Up to Date is next here on KCUR. So stay with us. And thank you very much for those of you who are listening.